All right. Good morning, everybody. It is June 30th and 10 a.m. for our Chem 3 lecture. And let's see, a couple of things. What do I need to tell you guys today? What sort of announcements do I have? I've got to go through my Rolodex of different announcements. Everybody's working on completing the test. I've asked you guys to complete that test by tonight. So I set a due date on it. I modified the due date, set it correctly, which I wanted it to be tonight. However, as I've said before, for those people who are asynchronous and following along with the lectures and sort of running a day behind, that due date is flexible, meaning that it doesn't just close when the due date ends. You can still go and complete the assignment. And once you complete the assignment, it may mark it late, but marking it late does not affect the number of points for the exam itself. So you will not lose points if you are taking that exam late or completing it late. That's just to give you guys some flexibility. So you don't need to ask me if you have something that comes up and you need an extra day in order to be able to complete that exam, then you have it. You can go and you can complete it late. Like I said, it'll still mark it late. Don't worry about that. It's just, I want to keep that deadline on there to keep people moving forward and to keep it in your minds that you should be completing it. But if you need the extra day, you can take the extra day or two to be able to finish it. I went through and I graded the quiz that we had earlier. So the quiz was the dimensional analysis quiz. That quiz has now been fully graded, and I'm fighting. Canvas and I are having an argument, and I think Canvas might be winning. I'm not sure. I downloaded all of your submissions. The majority of them by far were in PDF. There was only about six of them that were not in PDF format. The PDFs are very easy for me to edit and re-upload, because when I download them to my iPad, mark on them, and re-upload them, they stay in a PDF format, and then they re-upload to Canvas easily. Anything that's not in PDF format, I have to convert into PDF to get it into my iPad, and then convert it back into the original format to upload it so that it goes into its proper place once I put markings on it. So if you're not getting things put into PDFs, please try and get them into a PDF before uploading it rather than just uploading an image file. It makes it much more complicated for me to try to deal with it in that sense. I did not mark on everyone's files. I only marked on those that needed partial credit or that had a wrong answer or that something was amiss. And then I went through and made notations on your handwritten files that you submitted as to what you could do to improve or where you were going wrong. Those files I am still trying to get submitted back into Canvas. This is where Canvas and I are having the argument. And I need to get, I've contacted the people at Cabrillo who run Canvas at Cabrillo. They were flummoxed and could not figure out why it's not operating the way that it's supposed to be. And so my next challenge is to call Canvas itself and see if I can get one of their techs to help me figure out what's going wrong. But it seems to be in the system end and not in my end, that Canvas is not operating the way that the tutorial that the Canvas program puts out says that it is supposed to operate. The buttons just physically aren't there to re-upload the files the way that they're supposed to be. So, but the grades have all been fixed. So you can go and you can look at your dimensional analysis grade and see that I corrected it. In many cases where it took like 10 points off for having the sig figs wrong, I went back and gave you 9 out of the 10 points for having the sig figs incorrect, but still having the correct answer. That's the way that I tend to grade with partial credit. Anyway, I usually only take 1 point off for a sig fig as opposed to taking off the entire points. So anyway, I will do the same thing with the exam when you guys complete the exam. I will go through each individual's exam and make sure that I award partial credit in the way that I normally do when it's a handwritten test. And your submissions are going to help me do that. So trying to get them into a PDF and allowing me to then go through and read and look and see what your work was, that's important to me to be able to see your work. So please make sure that you upload those submissions, okay?
Whenever Canvas starts working, we'll see kind of, we'll see on the PDFs that you submit, like kind of how we did things wrong and stuff like that.
Yeah, so if there's a problem, I tend to, for expediency and efficiency, if you got the problem right, I don't tend to put any markings on those submissions. I kind of jump over those. But if there are things that were done incorrectly and I'm trying to figure out what it is that you're doing, then I will put a series of handwritten notes in directly on top of your notes showing you where you used a wrong conversion factor, or how you could have done a different roadmap, or you turned this conversion factor over or missed the sig figs. I'll go through and I'll mark out all of those things to show you what's going wrong. Okay. For the exam, once everyone has submitted, can we go over the correct answers together? We'll see if there's time. We could do that, or I could just put up an answer key to the exam, and maybe that would be a faster way, and then you guys could review that as you want to. Maybe that's a better way to do that, is to just release the answers to it, or put up an answer key that shows you the worked problems so that you can see it that way. That might be a better way to deal with it. So yes, I will do that, and we'll get that up. Any other questions come up? You guys doing okay? Everything's working out all right? Cool. Okay. Then if everything is looking good, how many people do we have? 32. Whew, this is making me concerned. I'm wondering if there's just not more people who are going asynchronous. And that may be that more people are, the exam is kind of bonkers. The exam is challenging. So I don't mean to laugh. That's true. The exam is a little challenging, but I try not to go overboard with the exam. I truncated it a little bit beyond what I normally do. I normally do a slightly longer exam, and it would be given in an hour and a half format. That's an hour and a half format that exam would be in. And to put that into perspective, you're doing an open book, open note exam. It takes you a little bit longer when you come in and you do an open book, open note exam. You tend to approach the exam in a different way. And I think that's also part of why I'm leaving it wide open the way that I am. When you come into class and you do it as a closed note, closed book exam, there's a lot more pressure on it. The problems wouldn't be any different, but your ability to be able to do those problems may be changed or modified. And that's where I grade with a lot of partial credit. I go through and I look at the work that you give me. I look at the roadmaps that you create. I look at the conversion factors and the way you string them together. And I award a lot of partial credit for many of those types of problems. As you go on to Chem 1A and Chem 1B, the material gets more complicated. The time pressure gets more complicated. And you need to kind of be ready to jump into that. Annalise, what isn't graded in Canvas yet? Maybe you could tell me. I didn't see, everything should be scored at this point except for the exam. Once the exam is completed by everybody, then I'll go through and do my part on the exam, and then everything should be graded, because I think I've gone through the quizzes and awarded partial credit for the various quizzes. Everything is not graded in the exam. That is correct, because what happens with the exam, there is the submission component. And because I have the submission component, even though there's no points awarded to it, because I required a submission, that requires me to go in and to verify each student's exam personally. And then once I do that, then the exam score will post. It won't post until I actually go through and do that. So maybe that's what you're seeing, Annalise. And Ayla, the electronic configurations are kind of bonkers to me, but maybe I just haven't done enough yet. Electronic configurations can be more challenging. Those aren't on the exam yet. I understand how those can be more challenging. I agree. When should we have that down, the electronic configurations? We'll have a quiz that I will put up probably towards the end of the week on electronic configurations. I don't know if I'll get it up tomorrow, but either tomorrow night or Thursday night, I'll get up a quiz on electronic configurations. And we're using the electronic configurations to jump off into nomenclature. And that's what we're going to do today, is primarily nomenclature. Okay, so that's kind of where we're at. So electronic configurations, the nice thing would be if you could get them down and I need to put some more problems up for chapter 3. So I need to put chapter 3 homework up, and that's where your practice is going to come in. And Ayla, maybe that'll help. If we can review measurements, we can review measurements, but I would rather not review measurements here in this format. I would rather review those in office hours if you can do that. So office hours every day from 3:30 until 5:15. And if you jump into office hours, I would be very happy to review measurements and show you how to do that. Okay. And I do need to I do need to get a problem set up for the I do need to get a problem set up for electronic configurations. The problem is, I don't know how to do electronic configurations in a problem set in Canvas. Canvas really isn't structured to do that. I have a worksheet that I tend to send out that gives you good practice in electronic configurations. And by the time you're done with that, you've got it down pretty well. And maybe what I ought to do is just release that and have it do as a submission and have you guys take and resubmit a PDF of that electronic configuration worksheet. Maybe that's the best thing that we can actually do. And that would bypass the book and do it all in that worksheet. So maybe I'll do that. Okay, I'll get an assignment up. I'll think about that, put a little more effort into that. Let's pick up from today. And we'll pick up where we left off, which I should have reviewed and I didn't. I think we had already jumped into nomenclature and started to look at ionic compounds. So the big things that are coming out of chapter 3. Chapter 3 is, number one, we're looking at electronic configurations. Number two, we're looking at electronic configurations of ions. Up here, we could say of elements. And then the third thing that we do is we look at ionic compounds. Both formation of basically how to write them and nomenclature. Which is how to name them. Those are the three big things that I want to get out of chapter 3. How to write an electronic configuration of the elements, how to write electronic configurations of ions, and then ionic compounds. We've already done 1 and 2. We've already done electronic configurations of the elements, and yesterday we did electronic configurations of the ions such that we showed formations of cations and formations of anions. And we also started to show how to write them in terms of their formulas by combining the cation and the anion. And we began a system of how to name them. Out of the different ionic compounds, there are three types of ionic compounds. Each of the three types has their own little changes in nomenclature, in the way that we name them, in the way that we use them. The three types are main group, cations with main group anions. When we say main group, we're talking about those cations that fall between 1A all the way through 3A for the cations. And for the main group anions, these are 5A, 5A through 7A for the anions. So those are the group numbers. That's one type. Second type is the transition metals. And these are with the main group anions. And the third type is where, and the transition metals, let's, let me hit that real quick. Transition metals are variable charge states. So like iron can be +2 and +3, or copper can be +1 and +2. So those are the transition metals that have variable charge states. And that means that we need to use the Roman numerals in the nomenclature. So the nomenclature changes slightly because of using the Roman numerals. Then we get into main group and transition metal. Cations. With what are called polyatomics. And those polyatomics are many atom anions. Anions that are composed of groups of elements as opposed to a single element. On the right, under the main group ions, there's a Roman numeral 8, but you said 7, because I can't count. 5, 6, 7. Thanks, Marisol. So those are the three types. I have yet to memorize the Roman numerals. Yeah, got to work on the Roman numerals. These are the three types. Out of the three types, yesterday we started to cover and primarily covered the first type. We talked about main group cations with main group anions. And I can't remember, and I should go back and I should look to see if we started talking about transition metals. I think that we hadn't. I think that we started to do that in the afternoon class. So now is a good time to pick up and look at the transition metal cations and then launch into the polyatomics and start talking about polyatomics as well, and showing how we can utilize those and the system. And mainly what I want to do here is I have two goals. My main goals are to show you how to use them. So show how to properly name them, write them and name them. But the other big goal is to show you how to memorize them by association. Basically cutting down how much memorization you do. How to be efficient in your memorization in chemistry. Trying to do it by association, by grouping things together. Basically, here's the idea. You can memorize three things. And if you memorize three things, that's about the most that your brain can hold in working memory is those three things. But if you take them and you combine them into these chunks where they're by association, you can memorize three times as many things because you're grouping them together in these groups. That's sort of the idea. And so rather than trying to take and trying to memorize, you know, 9 different things, or in the case of the polyatomics, which may be 20 or 30, what we try to do is we try to group them by association to make it easier to memorize. And so what I'm going to try to do is build those associations and show you how to be more effective in your memorization techniques and try to make it easier for you guys. That's the whole goal. So those are the goals for today. All right, let me start off, since I think we already did the main group metals with the main group anions, let's look at the transition metals with the main group anions. So this will be case number 2. Transition metals with main group anions. In the transition metals have variable charge states. The reason why they have variable charge states is because they have a number of different ways of utilizing their d orbitals to lose electrons. So when we look at the transition metals, most of what is happening in the transition metals, like in period three, In period four, we have the three Ds, the four S's and the three Ds. Get it right. Four S and three D orbitals. We have argon. And above argon, argon includes 18 electrons. Then we get into 4s. And above the 4s, we have the 3ds. And there are many different stable configurations of electrons within these orbitals. Resulting from the loss of one electron, two electrons, three electrons, even up to four electrons, sometimes as many as seven electrons. And there's some common patterns that we see that allow us to be able to produce certain ions in certain groups. So for instance, I think that what I've shown now a couple of times is looking at iron, which is element number 26. As I get lost and need a periodic table to reach for, iron number 26. And iron's electronic configuration has the argon core, which constitutes 18 electrons. That's the previous noble gas before iron. Then I've got the four S's and the three D's. And iron's electronic configuration, this would be 19, 20, 21, 22, 23, 24, 25, 26. Iron can go through a couple of different processes to lose electrons. In one situation, iron can lose two electrons. In another situation, iron can lose three electrons. And it makes electronic configurations. One, two, three, four, five. These are my three Ds, my four S, the argon core. When it loses two electrons, it loses one of the three Ds, and it loses one of the four S's, and this makes an iron, which has now a two positive charge on it, and has an electronic configuration, which is the argon core, 4S1, 3D5. This configuration is stable because it's stable in the same way that chromium is stable when we look at chromium's electronic configuration. This is isoelectronic with chromium.
Why does it have the two positive charge?
Because it's lost two electrons. It had 18, if we go back and we count, it had 18, 19, 20, 21, 22, 23, 24, 25, 26. So what we had here was we had 26 protons. That equals 26 positive charges. And we had 26 electrons, which equal 26 negative charges. So we were net zero. But when we came up to this situation, we still have 26 protons, giving me the 26 positive charges, now only demonstrating 18, 19, 20, 21, 22, 23, 24, 24 negatives.
Oh, I see. There it is. Okay.
And so that's your two positive charge.
Okay.
And in the other sense, when it loses three electrons, it falls to an electronic configuration where it's losing three electrons, two from the d's, and all of them from the s, or I guess it's one from the d and all from the s, so the s is empty, and the electronic configuration becomes iron, 3+. This now has the argon core, and it is a 4s0, 3d5. And that whole thing has now 3 less electrons. So we're 26 protons and 23 electrons. That's 26 positives and 23 negatives for a total of 3 positive charges.
How come it loses electrons from 4s first instead of 3d?
That's a really good question. And the answer is not easy to answer. That's a hard answer to give you. The answer to that is that having the half-filled 3d's is a very stable configuration. And even though the s's are empty, the electrons that are in the d's and the s's reformat in a way that allows for stability. I don't even know how I want to explain this. It's not an easy way to explain it, but basically what happens is the iron Fe3+ combines with things that we will call anions. And I'll give them a different name that says a ligand. A ligand is a term that we introduce in Chem 1A and Chem 1B. A ligand is anything that has electrons on it. So I'll use the dots to represent the electrons. And these ligands combine with iron, donating their electron density to the iron. And they fill up these other orbitals. They fill the 4s and they fill the 3d's in order to take the element to an electronic configuration, which is isoelectronic with one of the noble gases. And so what they wind up doing is they wind up picking up a total number of electrons to take them up to 18 electrons to be isoelectronic with the noble gas, with the argon. And so these orbitals, while they're being emptied and losing electrons that belonged to the iron, they get backfilled or filled with these electrons from the ligands that wind up binding to the iron. And they stabilize that 3 positive charge in the same way that they also stabilize this 2 positive charge. It's just that Fe2+ will combine with a different number of ligands than will Fe3+. Okay. It's not a super good answer. There are better answers, but they require a lot more work and a lot more showing you what actually happens. The orbitals that are here, these d orbitals, don't stay this way. They don't stay redundant. When they form these ions, the orbitals split and the orbitals wind up going, and I haven't done this in a long time, but the d orbitals wind up splitting into a 3+2. And so these are a combination of d orbitals. And the electrons will fall down into the lower set and leaving the upper set empty. And it depends upon whether they split that way or they split this way in how many electrons it winds up having. And so when we looked at up here, we had a set of 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. The electrons would split in this pattern into the d orbitals, filling the bottom set of 6 and completely filling it and leaving the upper set empty. And in this set where we've got 5, I don't remember exactly how the pattern works, but there's a pattern that results that allows for 5. And it's called crystal field splitting theory. And it doesn't come in until a year from now in Chem 1A or Chem 1B that you wind up getting into all of that and showing why it actually is stable. So there's a whole nother theory yet that needs to explain that.
Okay, thank you. And is that specific to iron, or is that different elements that do that?
No, it is specific to all of the transition metals that have d orbitals, and the d orbitals go through what is called a crystal field splitting theory, and they predict which of the ions then becomes the most stable for each one of those elements.
Interesting. Cool, yeah. Thank you.
At the Chem 3 level, what we do at the Chem 3 level is we memorize. At the Chem 3 level, we introduce and we tell you these are the most common, this is where they come from a little bit, and then we memorize which ones fit into which category. In the Chem 1B class, they actually go through why that is, where they come from, and they start to explain that aspect of it.
Thank you.
And out of curiosity, if you were to shoot that through a prism, would it still show the same color? That D, I forget what the D orbital stands for, what color it stands for.
Yeah, it does not. In fact, when you have the iron ion, the ion will show a different spectrum than will the iron, which is the atomic iron. So each of the ions themselves will show their own spectrum and will have different lines. The lines will all be adjusted. That is an excellent question too. And that is true because the lines result from the electronic transitions, from the electrons going up to higher orbitals and then falling back down. When you lose electrons, the orbitals change and the energies of the orbitals change. And the band gaps now are different, and therefore you will get different line spectrum. Every ion has its own line spectrum, different from the element from which it came from. So that is also true. And we also know how to track that and how to recognize that. So we can recognize those ions in clouds of ionized gas that sits around planets and suns, and we can recognize what elements are in those ionized clouds as well. Really cool concept. That's a great question, Jeremy. Okay. Eric, you had asked, do we have to write the 4s0? And the answer is no. You can leave the 4s0, so any orbitals that are empty that have zero things in them, you cannot write them. You can just leave them off the list, and that is okay as well. So that's a good question, Eric. All right. Having these different...
Is it incorrect if you do write them?
No, it is not incorrect. It is correct both ways. It's fine both ways. So what we're going to do is we're going to introduce a set of ions that I want you to be able to memorize. They are plus one and plus two. And I change the way I say it occasionally, but it should be written, it should be written with the value before the charge. Oh, my app is like freaking out. Stop it. Okay, there we go. Plus one, plus two, plus two, and plus three. And two plus and four plus. These are the sets. And what I do is I try to memorize these two sets and then allow everything else to fall into the middle set. In the plus one and plus two category, there is copper, which comes in a plus one, and copper, which comes in a two plus. And there is mercury, which is an oddball, because mercury looks like they're both two plus. But you have to realize that the first one is polyatomic. Poly meaning many. So it has multiple ions or many atoms connected together to form an ion. And what that is it is a mercury bound to another mercury. And the whole set has a two positive charge. If you take that charge and disperse it over each mercury then has a single positive charge. So we think of this as a mercury, which is a plus one, even though it's written in a funky way. So there's two in that category. There are two in this category over here. There is lead, which is a two plus, and there is lead, which is a four plus. And there is tin, which is a two plus. And tin, which is a four plus. So there are two in that category. I try to memorize these And then anything else I know falls into the 2 plus and 3 plus. And then I don't have to memorize the other things. I just know it's not one of these, so it must be in the middle category. The things that fall in the middle category are iron, manganese, chromium, nickel, cobalt, and so these are the most common of the charge states. There are other charge states beyond this, many other charge states beyond this. But these are the most common charge states. So that's what I ask you to put effort into. And like I said, put effort into the lead and the tin, the copper and the mercury, and everything else falls in the middle, making it so much easier. Because you know if it's not copper, mercury, lead, or tin, then it must be a 2 plus or 3 plus. Now, once we have these charge states, and we understand what these charge states are for these metals, then we can go and we can utilize these metals, and we can make compounds with these metals and the anions that are the nonmetals. So let's do transition metals. With main group anions. To start off with, we can demonstrate a problem that is, for iron, there are two possible compounds that can be formed with oxygen. In one of these, the iron is a 2 plus iron and the oxide a 2 minus. They come together in a balanced ratio of 1 to 1 because their charges are identical but opposite. In the iron with 2 and oxide with 3, the iron is the 3 plus. And they combine in ratios of 2 to 3 in order to balance out the negatives and the positives for a total of 6 negatives and 6 positives. These are completely different compounds with different physical properties, and therefore they should have different names. So these should be, or require, different names. Let's do it that way. In requiring different names, there's two different naming systems that we use. There's one naming system, which is the new naming system, that uses Roman numerals. To denote or indicate the charge state. So for instance, Fe2 plus equals iron, Roman numeral 2, and Fe3 plus equals iron, Roman numeral 3. These Roman numerals indicate the charge state, not how many anions are present in the formula. So these Roman numerals are specific and only about the metal itself. The other naming system, an old naming system, used roots and suffixes to denote charge state. This system has been supplanted by the Roman numerals. The Roman numerals is a better system because it tells you exactly the charge state. So you know that it's either 2 or 3. But this older system, the older system used suffixes that were IC for the high charge state, and OUS for the low charge state. Didn't tell you what the charge state was. You need to memorize the charge state. So this one doesn't work so well, or at least is more difficult to use. Examples of this would be that the iron Fe3 plus is called ferric, and Fe2 plus is called ferrous. So we are recognizing that in this sense, the 3 plus goes with the IC, the high charge state, and the 2 plus, the OUS, with the low charge state. What about negatives? I'm trying to think if there's any. I can't think of any, Ellis, anions that have multiple charge states. And so we don't have a nomenclature system to deal with multiple negative charge states. I'm sure that within chemistry, I can probably find a couple of examples within certain metals way down in the periodic table that can take on negative charges. But at the moment, off the top of my head, I can't think of any. And so, so the anions are fixed and their charge states don't vary in the way that these do. So this means that when I'm looking at these different compounds, that I can have different names for the different compounds. FeO, in which this is the 2 plus charge state of the iron, this can be named iron, Roman numeral 2, oxide, or it could be the ferrous oxide, both indicating that that is the iron 2 plus. And for Fe2O3, where this iron is the 3 plus iron, this is now iron Roman numeral 3 oxide and ferric oxide is its alternate name. So we have the different names that we can use for these materials. All right, so let's work forward from this. Let's make a new compound. And let's look, or we can write out copper, Roman numeral 1. Let's do it as a sulfide. And over here, we will compare that with copper Roman numeral 2 sulfide. How about Fe3O4? There is no Fe3O4. That's a good question. Actually, there could be, but it's not one of the common ones. So if we looked at Fe3O4, and I'll do that down here just really quickly. If we were to write a formula Fe3O4, that would imply that I have three ions. So Fe, and four oxides, 2-, 2-, 2-, and 2-. That's not to say that this doesn't exist, but that would be a total of 2, 4, 6, 8, 8 negative charges. That means that I have to have 8 positive charges, and 8 positive charges divided by 3 ions would give me not a fixed number. That would give me a number that is not a standard round number, and I can't have partial charges. So without an ability to have partial charges, what this would have to be is it would have to be a mixed ion of 2 that are 3 plus and 1 that is 2 plus. And so this would be a mixed salt. And I don't even know exactly how this would be named, but it's not falling under our standard nomenclature, Roxanne. It's a different, I know that this compound exists. I've seen it before. And I think that it's named iron 3/iron 2 oxide. And so we give it a name that is something like this, iron 3/iron 2 oxide, but it's not a standard thing, and it's not something that I'm going to ask you to do at this level. It's not, oh, hang on a second. Let me go, actually, this is a good spot for a 10-minute break. Take a 10-minute break. I'll be right back. All right, I'm back. I don't know how long a break that was. I guess, and my dogs are everywhere. You probably heard them barking. I had somebody at the door, and they were dropping off something, so I had to go grab that quick. And that's why I needed to run so fast. And I didn't get you guys music or anything. Bummer. I'm trying to think what time I took off. I took off at like 11. I think it was like 11:09, which means that we've got a few more minutes to go. So I'm going to let it go a few more minutes, and then we'll pick it up. If it was 11:09, and my memory serves me right, then we come back at 11:19, which gives me four more minutes. So I'm going to do that. I'm going to put some music on. Ah, stop this barking.
Simba, oh, you raise your head, beat the sun, but your voice, they lie so close to you. Do you dare get up and wake the two? Oh, Elias, I see you there at work in the daytime. Do you think you could answer all the questions of the world? Just one word, I think you could. And Manuel, well, you know, they're at school now, given the chance that their father's never seen. See what's beyond section 17. And in 10 years, when you look back at your hard boys, well, you know they've grown way taller than the tallest sugar cane.
All right, coming back. Let's try broadcasting again. Bring up notability. And yeah, I apologize for that abrupt break. I hope that worked out for you okay. I had somebody at the door and they were delivering a present for my wife because her birthday was this weekend. And so I needed to go run and deal with that really quickly, which is why my dogs were all freaking out. Let's jump back into it. We were looking at this compound, which I was saying was a mixed compound. It had both iron 3 and iron 2. Those are rare. You don't see those a lot, and you don't see those within the Chem 3 curriculum ever. You really only see those within within Chem 1A, Chem 1B, and even not there very often, I would say. So those are sort of a rare sort of circumstance when you're looking at a compound like that. And we were going to look at this copper 1 and copper 2. So let's write these out real quick and learn how to do these guys. The copper 1 is telling you that this is the copper, which is a plus 1. And the sulfide is an S. It's from sulfur. And when you look at the periodic table and you find where sulfur is located in the periodic table, you'll see that it is in group 5A, 4A, no, 6A, 6A, in group 6A. In group 6A, this is a 2 minus anion. And so what it requires is it requires two of the coppers to get two positives to match the two negative. And the formula then would be Cu subscripted 2S. In the copper 2 sulfide, this is copper 2 plus with S2 minus. And so these go together in a 1-to-1 ratio to make the two positives and the two negatives. And that is just CuS. And so we have the two different compounds there, copper 1 sulfide and copper 2 sulfide. And we can name these with the other names. This one is the low charge state. So this is cuprous sulfide. And the other one, the high charge state, would be cupric sulfide. So again, the OUS, meaning low charge state, and that is the plus 1, and the IC, meaning high charge state. It doesn't tell me what the charge is. It just denotes the difference between the low and the high. That's all that naming system does for us. Okay, so once we get the transition metals, then the only thing that is complicated is working backwards. And I had shown working backwards from this example, but I'm going to show it formally. So we're going to actually, let's get this example out of the notes. That will just confuse people later. And let's show examples of working backwards. From the formula to the name. So let's say that I have a formula that is Cr, I'm trying to think of, let's do iodide, I3. And I want to know what the name of this compound is. In order to name this compound, I need to know what the charge state. So before I can name it, I need to know the charge state on the chromium. But in order to figure out the charge state on the chromium, because the chromium is variable, chromium variable, however, iodide is fixed. It does not vary. And so what we do is we look to the anion. We write it out in the table in the format in which we would to balance it. And we look at these fixed charge states. So when we say that iodine is fixed, we're saying that these guys are each a negative charge. That results in three negative charges. In order for this to be a valid compound, I need to have three positive charges. And so that denotes or tells me that this must be the chromium 3 plus. So I work backwards from the charges on the anions to figure out the charge on the cation.
When we say that ionide is fixed, that just means like one negative charge per iodide?
When we say it's fixed, what we mean is that each anion on the periodic table, if I bring a periodic table into the discussion, what we mean is that each family has their own distinct charge. These guys are all minus one. These are all minus two. These are all minus three. These are plus one, plus two, and plus three.
Okay.
And that these are fixed. So these are fixed in that way. And they work for the whole family and they don't vary. Whereas over here, we had things like iron could be 2 plus and 3 plus, and copper is a plus 1 and a 2 plus. And so I don't know, zinc is only a plus 2, but manganese 2 plus and 3 plus, and chromium 2 plus and 3 plus. So I don't know what the charge state is. These guys, what we say is that these guys are variable, but these guys are fixed.
Thank you.
Yeah, you're welcome. So we use the fixed charge state and we work backwards from the fixed charge state. So that's what we mean. And we could do that for any metal. For any metal, we could go through. Did we name this? We didn't name this yet. We should name this. This is a chromium 3 plus. So this one gets named chromium, Roman numeral 3, iodide. Or this one, being the high charge state, could be called chromic iodide. Another example of that. Let's take and look at manganese, and I'll combine it with nitride. So here, working backwards, there are three nitrogens and two manganese. The nitrogens are fixed, so these are each three minus. From the periodic table, they fall here in the three minus column, and so they are fixed at three minus. That gives me a total of 369. Ooh, and I did this the wrong way. Did I? Yes, I did. I apologize. I meant to go this way. Otherwise, it's not going to work out. Okay. Now it'll work out. That gives me six negative charges and implies that there must be a total of six positive charges. So what I do is I take that six and I divide it by however many ions I have. And that means that each of these ions is going to have to be a 2 positive. So we take...
Why would you do that?
Well, we're taking the total positive charges. And equally distributing them.
So it's not balanced because you have a 6 plus and a 6 minus?
Well, no, it is balanced. 6 plus and 6 minus means balanced. But what I have done is I have taken the 6 positive charges and I have equally distributed the 6 positive charges among the 3 magnesiums and or manganeses. And that distribution gives me 2 positive charges on each one. 2 plus 2 is 4 plus 2 is 6. So they add up to 6. So I'm equally distributing them. So in other words...
Oh, I was reading it the wrong way. Thank you.
Yeah. So in other words, divide total charges by number of ions. So we're dividing 6 charges by 3 ions, and we get 2 positive charges on each one. And therefore, now we can name this. Now we know that it is the 2 plus. So this becomes manganese, Roman numeral 2, nitride. Or we can name it manganese nitride. Because manganese comes in a plus 2 or plus 3, the OUS is the lower charge state, the plus 2, so that's manganese nitride. So there we have all the names. And with that, you can name any of those compounds using the transition metal names. From there, what we need to do is we need to start introducing and talking about polyatomics. And the polyatomics is where things start to get crazy. First off, what is a polyatomic ion? Poly means many. And atomic, we're using to represent atom. And so this can be read as a many atom ion. That's what polyatomic is really converting into a meaning. So how does that work? One of the examples that I like to show for how that works is taking a look at oxygen and hydrogen with a negative charge on it, which is called hydroxide. Hydroxide is an example of an ion that has 2 different elements in the ion, in the ion. And we can look at oxygen's contribution and hydrogen's contribution and the number of protons and the number of electrons. And oxygen contributes 8 protons and 8 electrons. And hydrogen contributes 1 proton and 1 electron. And so our sums of these are 9 protons and 9 electrons. And what this charge implies up here is this charge says that there is 1 more electron than protons. And so I have to include 1 more electron than the total number of protons. And so this gives me 10 electrons. That's 10 negative charges. And 9 protons. So 9 protons means 9 positive charges. And that results in a minus 1 charge when I add those together. And so that's the hydroxide ion. The hydroxide ion, the idea behind this ion is no different than an atomic ion. An atomic ion has more electrons or less electrons than the total number of protons, so does a polyatomic. So a polyatomic ion is exactly the same, has more or less electrons than total number of protons. That's what the definition of a polyatomic ion is. And the problem with polyatomics is there are a ton of them, and they all need to be memorized. But trying to memorize them all can be very challenging, particularly in a 6-week summer course when you're trying to memorize them in a fast-paced rate. And so fortunately, our books are open note, open book, and you can do other things. You can use tables and things in order to be able to help you with the polyatomic ions, because I'm not going to force you to memorize them. There's no way that I'm going to be able to test you in terms of memorizing them. But when you move into Chem 1A and Chem 1B, you need to have these in your working memory, and they will test you in a closed book, closed note sense, and you will have to have them memorized. And so it makes sense to try to get them into your working memory anyway, so that when you go into Chem 1A, you're prepared. So these polyatomics, how do we memorize them? They're built into families. And in order to memorize them, I build them into families. Remember that whole concept of, if I have a whole bunch of things and I'm trying to memorize this whole bunch of things, that chunk them into 3 string chunks and memorize them together. And in so doing that, it makes the memorization easier. So what I do is I break these into families. And beyond the families, then there is another type of family that I call a proton family. These families up here, these are parent families, and then we have proton families. And then beyond the families and the proton families, then we have what I call the one-offs. And the one-offs are just what they sound like. There's no family. They're just a single thing that need to be memorized. So I think of these in 3 different types. And this parent family is related to the proton families. And so really, this parent family, if you can memorize this parent family, this part, the proton family, is easy. And then all you got to work on is the one-offs. So what we'll do is we'll build out several families for memorization for these guys. And those families start by looking at the chlorine family. In the chlorine family, if we look at chlorine, when I change it to a chloride, the ending, IDE, denotes the monatomic anion that is the chloride. So the IDE ending is indicative of what that charge state is on the chlorine. From there, we can look at the compounds of chlorine and oxygen. These compounds with oxygen, there are 4 of them. It starts off ClO minus and goes to ClO2 minus, ClO3 minus, and ClO4 minus. Each of them has the exact same charge state as the parent compound. I don't want to do red because that's not going to help me. Maybe I'll just do it this way. So they have the same charge state as the parent. We'll say the monatomic ion. And it's true for all of them, that they all have that same -1 charge state. And the names that I use for these have a root. The root that I use is the chlor. So this is the root. And that root, we can also see it here, chlor, in terms of the chloride. And then I use a suffix that tells me how many oxygens there are. That suffix is either a chlorate or a chlorite, or I should say it's the eight or the ite. Eight equals more oxygen, and ite equals less oxygen. And then I have a prefix that I can apply to this. And the prefix fitting in here, the prefix is going to add oxygen or reduce oxygen in a way so that this one is still a chlorate, but I put a prefix in front of it that says per. And the per equals one more than the ATE. And down here, I use hypo. And hypo means less. So this equals one less than the ITE, the ite. And we also need to get the ITE name in there. This is the entire system. Eric, grim question, what is chloroform? Chloroform is in a form of organic nomenclature. Chloroform is where we take, and it is a shared, so these are all ionic compounds sharing cations and anions. In an organic sense, chloroform is a compound that is composed of chlorine, carbon, and hydrogen in a covalently bound sense. And it comes from the idea that a CH is a formal group. And so this is chloroform, chlorine with the formal group in order to produce a molecule. And that nomenclature system is a very different system that you don't hit until Chem 12, which is not a year from now, it's like a year and a half from now in terms of chemistry. It's three more classes before we get there. But that's what chloroform is. So it's not ionic, it's a different type of nomenclature system. Okay, this nomenclature system of going perchlorate, chlorate, chlorite, hypochlorite, this nomenclature system is conserved and is used for all of the molecules. However, we don't see per and we don't see hypo very often, but I like to use this system because it shows you the extent of what is possible and how the system is used, even though we don't regularly see this entire system. And for instance, we can take this system and we can build it out and we could say, what about bromine? From bromine, we have the bromide. And from bromide and chloride are in the same family. If we go back to that periodic table, where is that thing? There we go. Notice that chlorine and bromine are right next to each other in the periodic table. Remember, we said that these are families with similar chemical reactivities and that they form similar types of compounds. And so the compounds that we can form from bromine are analogously BrO4 minus, BrO3 minus, BrO2 minus, and BrO minus. And this is hypobromite. This is bromite, bromate, and per. bromate. And we have the exact same system and the exact same set of analogous compounds. So it becomes very easy to memorize, because what we're doing is we're pulling the charge from here. That charge is the same charge. And then they build in sequence of one oxygen to two, to three, to four. For the middle ones, the smaller one is the ite, the larger one is the ate. We go up one, we get perbromate. We go down one, we get hypobromite. So the system kind of works like that. From there, we start to introduce other families. And there are a series of families that we build into this. So these are the main group families. We'll put them all, see if I can fit them all in here. The main families are the chlorine family that we just explored, a sulfur family, a phosphorus family, and a nitrogen family in combinations with oxygen. So this family we just did, ClO4 minus, ClO3 minus, somehow that got off, ClO3 minus, ClO2 minus, and ClO minus. In the sulfur family, sulfide, so this one was chloride, this one is sulfide, the parent. The sulfide starts off with SO4 2 minus and SO3 2 minus, and there are only those two. And so when there are only two in this way, we say that this one is the sulfate and the sulfite. With phosphorus, phosphorus is a 3 minus, and this is phosphide. Phosphide has a PO4 3 minus and a PO3 3 minus. So notice that the charge, the 2 minus, is conserved, and the 3 minus is conserved throughout these. This one is the phosphate with more oxygens, and the phosphite with less oxygens. And then nitrogen, we would assume would be identical because it's in the same family with phosphorus. This is nitride, but this one is a little bit different. It's NO3 with a single minus, and NO2 with a single minus. And so the charges are not conserved here. I would say that this charge is different than these guys. So we need to be careful of that. And name-wise, the names work out just fine. This is the nitrate and the nitrite. And so what I do is I essentially build four flashcards. I build my nitrogen family. And have my nitrogen family. I build a flashcard for my phosphorus family. I build a flashcard for my sulfur family. And I build one for my chlorine family, which sort of exemplifies all of it. So this was the perchlorate. We'll bring this back in here. The chlorate, the chlorite, and the hypochlorite. So where do we see these things? You see them all over. I mean, hypochlorite is what you use as bleach. So hypochlorite, sodium hypochlorite, is bleach. Nitrates, nitrites, these are things that we worry about in the foods that we eat, in meat preservatives that include nitrates and nitrites. You'll see phosphates and phosphites in water quality and issues, fertilizers, phosphates or fertilizers. You'll see sulfates and sulfites in wine, winemaking and things, that these are common byproducts of the winemaking process. Perchlorate is an oxidizing agent that is used in rocket fuel. Many different sources that we see of all of these common ions that are derived from these elements. So these are the main group families. From these families, what I like to introduce from these main families are the proton families. So proton families, as we move into those, I'll show you an example of a proton family. By proton family, what I look at is, and I take this one because it's one of the biggest that I can work with, PO4 3-. This is the phosphate. Phosphate, you can take and you can add hydrogen ions to. So let's look at a hydrogen ion real quick. Let's make sure we understand what we're looking at. Hydrogen ion, this is one proton and zero electrons. So we sometimes just call this a proton because it has no electrons. It is essentially a proton, and that's what a hydrogen ion is. When I add that hydrogen ion, the charge on this phosphate is telling me that there are three extra negative charges. If I add a positive charge, then there will only be two extra negative charges. And so the formula goes HPO4, but the charge increments to 2.
What do you mean by proton family?
Well, that's what I'm doing, is that I'm taking protons and I'm adding protons. So okay. I'm about to create a family. And okay. I'm going to do that multiple times. This becomes H2PO4 with a single minus charge. And I can add another proton, and it becomes H3PO4. These ions, and this one's neutral, but these ions are linked together in that they are all derived from phosphate, and they are all named from phosphate. So this one is hydrogen phosphate. This one is dihydrogen phosphate. And the book and many other sources teach you to memorize these as separate entities. I like to group them as a family, as a proton family, that all have the same name, phosphate. And if you can remember the 3- charge, that came from the phosphorus that had the 3- charge, then you can increment and add hydrogens to this. And each time you add hydrogen, you downgrade it by 1. So we go from a 3- to a 2- to a 1- based on the number of hydrogens that I'm adding. It is 3 subtract 1 to get 2-, or actually I should say 3 plus 1 to get 2-, and 2- plus 1 to get the single minus. So instead of having to memorize the charge states, and instead of having to memorize the names, what you can do is you can link these in your memory to phosphate and rebuild them anytime you need them, which is kind of nice. So we can use hydrogen as a universal proton adder, neutralizer, sort of. That's how acid base works. And when we get to acid base, that's kind of what we do with acid base. Yes, that hydrogen is a proton source and adds protons to neutralize anions. This name down here, by the way, is no longer an ion. This is a molecule. And it gets a different sort of name. It's called phosphoric acid. And so that's a proton family. by the way, from that proton family, we can take and we can look at what is going on here with phosphate. Remember that there is also phosphite that has the 3- charge. So I'm looking to see. Oops, sorry, Ayla, I didn't see your question. So the parts that get the suffixes 8 and ite depend on the whole set. Was that the question, Ayla?
Yes, that was.
Okay. Let me go back up to that. When we look at 8 and ite, the 8 and ite are really not, it's not the entire set per se. 8 and ite, what we do is 8 is more oxygens, ite is less oxygens. We set those at the middle, and then if there are more, then we go and we use per, and if there are less, we go and we use hypo. But when there are only two ions, such as sulfate and sulfite, phosphate, phosphite, nitrate, nitrite, we always use the 8 for the more and the ite for the less. I just like to explain with the chlorine family that goes through the entire system, and then show you for these where we have sort of a truncated system. Does that help, Ayla?
Kind of, yeah.
Can you, maybe if that didn't totally satisfy it, maybe you can ask the question in another way that can allow me to explain better. Not to put you on the spot, but.
maybe at the end or something. I'm trying the best way to formulate what's going on in my head is.
Okay, that's cool. Hang on to it. And when we get to the end of the class, I'll hang out for a little bit and we can chat and see if we can't explain it better. When does it become a molecule, no longer an ion? Sierra, that is when it no longer has a charge on it. So when the molecule, we go from ions, so all of these guys are up here, are ions having a charge on them. And then we get down to here and there is no charge. That's when it goes from being an ion to a molecule. So molecules are neutral, whereas ions have charges. That's the difference. Molecule equals something that is neutral and many atoms, more than one atom. And an ion is something that is charged, either positive or negative. Yeah, either positive or negative. Okay. I was trying to do another thing. I wanted to show you that from phosphorus, we went to the phosphate, PO4, 3-, and we went to, so this is phosphorus, gives rise to these two families, 3-, and out of these, I also have HPO4, 2-, H2PO4-, and I can go all the way down to H3PO4, which is the molecule. Here I can do the same thing. HPO3, 2-, H2PO3-, and H3PO3, and I can do the same thing. I want to name these now. I'm going to split them apart a little bit. This one was phosphate and phosphite. This one was, there's not going to be enough room here. They need to be farther apart. This one was hydrogen phosphate. And this one, hydrogen phosphite. This one was dihydrogen phosphate and dihydrogen phosphite. And then we had phosphoric acid. And this one is phosphorus acid. And so the difference here is that the ATE ending at the end goes to IC acid. And the OUS or the ITE ending goes to the OUS acid, is the way that that nomenclature system works. And so from phosphorus, we can name all of these different systems. And watch this. If we take the sulfur family, 2-, and we had SO4 2-, and we have SO3 2-, its proton family becomes HSO4 minus HSO3 minus. This one was the sulfate. And this one, the sulfite. The name follows suit that this is hydrogen sulfate. And this one is hydrogen sulfite. You see the commonality of what we're doing, of how we name these systems? For the families, for the acid families. And then we can go to the molecular, where this becomes H2SO4, and this becomes sulfuric acid. And it got that sulfuric acid because it ended in ATE, so I picked up IC acid. This one ends in ITE. So when I do this acid, it will be H2SO3, and it will be sulfurous acid, ending in the OUS acid ending, in the way that those systems work. And this process continues, building these hydrogen families. And so what I do then is I go and I make a flashcard for each of the hydrogen families in that sense. I will take and I will make a flashcard that will remind me of this family, and a flashcard for this family. And I build it out that way in terms of families. Is that helping somewhat in terms of seeing how the system works and how to build it out?
I have a quick question.
Yeah.
You know how, so with the chlorine
yes.
chloride family, you have like the 8 that represents more oxygen and the 8 that represents less oxygen?
Yes.
So when you look at the ones that we just did in the proton family?
Yes.
I mean that whenever it's 4 oxygens, it becomes 8. And then whenever it's 3 oxygens, it's 8. Is that like the cutoff line, 3 and 4?
No, that's close. That was so close. You were like grasping. You were there. You had it. And the answer is no. Sorry, womp womp. What happens is, like in the nitrogen family, when I have nitride, this gives rise to 2 families, and it is the NO3 with a minus charge, and the NO2 with a minus charge. And this one is nitrate and nitrite. And so it doesn't follow the 4 and 3, okay, that this one is 3 and 2. It really just literally means more or less. It doesn't actually tell you how many. So that's actually good that we make sure that we dispel that myth and don't let that propagate.
So if there's like an NO6 and an NO5, would the 6 be nitrate and the other nitrite, or how would that
if be? We had a formula such as that, yes, the larger would be the 8 and the smaller would be the 8. That would be correct.
Okay.
Yes. And this one, when it goes to HNO3, goes directly to the acid, and there's nothing in between, and the HNO2, and this becomes nitric acid following the ATE. Anything that was ATE becomes IC acid. The other one, we said that if it were ITE, it would become the OUS acid, and so this becomes nitrous acid. And that's where that name comes from. So we have the families that are here, the phosphorus family, the sulfur family, and the nitrogen family. What we haven't covered is we haven't covered the one-offs. And the one-offs, we can see if there's any other questions there. Eric, I don't know exactly. Nitric, got it. All right. Nitrous acid. From here, we have the one-off ones that just have to be memorized as singulars. So these one-offs are things like hydroxide, cyanide, MnO4 minus permanganate. Although you can see that from permanganate, this is part of that system that is dealing with per and eight. So that manganate, there are many different ions. You're going to have the manganites and the other things. And so permanganate shows you where that one comes from. Hydroxide, cyanide, permanganate, thiocyanate, SCN minus. This is thiocyanate, C2H3O2 minus. This one is called acetate. I'm going to look and see if I've got a list of other ones that I want to pull up.
Sir, for the SCN minus, is that capital S, capital C, capital N?
Yes, it is a sulfur, a carbon, and a nitrogen. So it's capital S, capital C, capital N. The ones that I'm missing, that I am forgetting, oh, almost had them. Yeah, there's chromate and dichromate. Oh, and carbonate. Oh, that's such the important one. This is the one I was looking for. CO32 minus carbonate is important. And to a lesser extent, the CrO42 minus, which is called chromate, and Cr2O72 minus. This one is called dichromate and does not follow the pattern. Those are the one-offs.
Did you say Cr2O72 minus, or is that just minus?
Nope, 2 minus. You're right. I said 2 minus and I wrote minus.
So with the other ones you want us to memorize, you want us to memorize like all the specific names and stuff that we went over, or just the main family that it's in?
The idea there is to be able to use them interchangeably to be able to make ions with both the main group metals and the transition metals. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to give you a compound, say NaOH 3 PO4 or MG H PO4 or FE, I don't know what I want. HSO3 three times, or copper combining with OH two times. And to be able to go through and to name these, or to give you the names of things and have you be able to write the proper formula from each one of these things. So what do these mean? How am I breaking these down and showing these as examples? Let's sort of like fit it like this. The example up here, Na, are three sodiums, each with a positive charge. Sodium is a main group metal, so it has a fixed charge state. This is a 3- charge, so I have 3 negatives and 3 positives. And the name of this molecule is sodium phosphate. So recognizing this guy is the phosphate ion, and being able to know both its name and its formula. So that if I gave you its name, you could also write the formula for it. And over here, we've got the sodium ion. Magnesium is also main group. So here what I have is I have a magnesium, and I have just 1 HPO4. This has a 2- charge, and this has a 2+ charge. So this one was hydrogen phosphate, and this one magnesium ion. So the whole name is magnesium hydrogen phosphate. For the iron, this one, if I wanted to name it, I have to work backwards because I don't know what charge state the iron is. So I'll have to do some work to figure out what that charge state is. But what I do know is that there are 3 of these HSO3s. And so from working memory, I'll pull out SO3 had a 2- charge, the same as sulfur. So sulfide had a 2-, so the SO3 has a 2-. And then when I put a proton on it, I'll increment it down by 1, so each one of these has a -1 charge. That's how my brain does that. I'll say that one more time. I see the SO3, I ignore the hydrogen. Hydrogen is part of the hydrogen family. SO3, I don't know what the charge state is, but I remember that sulfur from the periodic table is 2-. They have to have the same charge state. So now this has a 2-. Then I throw in a +1, and I take 2- and a +1 results in a -1. I could memorize it, and I could just memorize HSO3 always has a negative charge on it. But I can also go through a thought process where I can come up with the right charge if I can't remember that. That's what I'm trying to do. Yes, you should also memorize the one-offs, Eric. So that comes later in a second. From here, there are a total of 3 negative charges. And so there must be 3 positives. And this must be the iron, which is the 3+. So this is iron, Roman numeral 3. And this one is hydrogen sulfite, the less oxygen one. And so the name of this compound is iron, Roman numeral 3, hydrogen sulfite. Or I had another name for iron 3, didn't I? Iron 3 was the ferric ion. So this could be ferric.
Do we need to be able to write the like ferric or ferrous version?
So the answer to that is you get to choose whichever one you want to use. But if I'm going to ask you to write the formula for something, I get to use whatever name I want to use. Equal opportunity. So we have to, you have to be able to work with both. That's the answer to that, is you have to be able to work with both. The copper here, likewise, I have copper and I have two of these things that are hydroxide, and I would need to be able to keep that name in working memory. There are two negatives. That means there must be two positives, and this is the copper 2+. So that means that this compound is copper, Roman numeral 2, hydroxide. Or the other name for that would be cupric hydroxide.
Wait, I'm confused about why we do the Roman numerals for the last two that we've done, but we don't write them for the first two. Is it something to do with the parentheses?
These guys here were main group metals. Main group metals have a single charge state and do not require a Roman numeral.
Oh, that's right. Okay, thank you. Sorry.
Yeah, that's okay. These guys are transition. So the transition metals have variable charge states, and they require the Roman numeral in order to tell which metal it is that you're actually dealing with. And that just goes to a perfect example. That question is because I have overwhelmed you with more than three concepts, and your brain is going, all right, I can't hold all these in working memory.
Yes.
And that's exactly what winds up happening at this point, is that all of a sudden this just went. And I told the morning group as we started to look at this, this is where the wheels come off the cart, because all of a sudden there's so much to keep track of that you can't keep track of all of those things, which is why I try to lead you to it through association at first and trying to reduce down the memorization. But then the only other way to get these is to work with them, is to practice them. And so I need to give you enough practice writing these and working with these and naming these. And that's my job, to give you guys work to do to be able to actually build these and use these. That's what's coming next. All right. I could do more examples of these, but we are 3 minutes from the end of class. And as I just stated, I think I have overwhelmed your brains at this point, and this is a good stopping spot. And let's just open it up for questions. And I'll stick on the line for a few minutes. And anybody who has any questions, you're welcome to jump in. And if not, you're also welcome to log off, and we will catch up in the afternoon lab, or we will catch up tomorrow, or we will catch up as I send out announcements later on whatever assignments I'm able to create tonight for you guys to practice with and set up all of that stuff. Marisol, you want to see the families.
Thank you.
Marisol, you want to go, I'm not sure, this one, main families, is that what you're looking for, Marisol? I'm going to guess that that's probably the area that you wanted. Yeah, you're welcome.
So would everything from today's lesson be something that we should basically have memorized?
Yeah, you know, yes and no. It's going to be impossible in a six-week class to be able to memorize these in the short amount of time that we've got. What I'm going to do is give you some practice stuff to try to. And what I would do is just try to use them, but know that all of our quizzes and our exams are open book, open note, and you're not going to be forced to have to memorize these. If you can create a cheat sheet for yourself of the families and the ions and their names all grouped together, that would serve you very well. That would be a good recommendation.
You said the names, the families, and the ions?
Yeah, so what I would do is I would create a sheet that is much like I have my main families and then how I was breaking these into proton families, and see if you can create sort of like an 8.5 by 11 sheet where you work out your own organization of the main families and their proton families that have the formulas and the names in a way that you can easily find them and read them. And if you can do that on like a single sheet of paper, or maybe even on two sheets of paper, so that you have a list of them, all easily identifiable in one place. That would really help you to create that, to use on the homework and to use on whatever assignments or quizzes or exams I'm going to give you. So that would be my recommendation.
Cool, thank you.
You're welcome.
Jason, could you go back down to the last part of the notes, I think?
Okay, Edgar, I'm seeing your note from you. Hang on the line, Edgar, and we'll talk. The last page of the notes? I'm sorry, I didn't.
Yeah.
Here.
Right. Yeah, right there. I'm confused as to the iron hydrogen sulfide. How did you know that it was an S2-? Like SO32-. How did you know that it was a 2-?
What I did is I built back from the periodic table. If I take a look at the periodic table, what we said was that for most of these ions, the family, it's a great sound, the families come from, I thought it just came in here. What did I do? Where'd it go? I was trying to bring in a periodic table and it didn't drop in. One more time. Notability, same note, import. Oh, it's dropping down a page. That's okay.
It's because the sulfur is -2, right?
Yes, it's because the sulfur is -2. So when I look at sulfur,
sorry.
Go ahead. No, you go ahead.
What about on the sodium phosphate where we have PO3-?
Because phosphorus is a 3-.
But oxygen is a 2-. So do we always go with the bigger number?
It's the parent from the family. So when you're looking at, we're not going from the oxygen, we're going from the phosphorus as the parent of the family. So it's the phosphorus, the sulfur, the thing on the left that is giving rise to the charge state.
Now it all makes sense.
Okay. Good.
Thank you.
You're welcome, Vanessa.
So what's on the left is the parent, or how do you know which one is the parent?
When we built the families, what we did is we started by looking at chlorine, the thing on the left, as the parent of the family, combining with oxygen in different ratios. Sulfur as the parent, combining with oxygen in different ratios. Phosphorus as the parent, combining with oxygen in different ratios. Nitrogen is the parent, combining with oxygen in different ratios. Does that make sense?
Kind of, yeah. But when you see them in larger things, is it always
chlorine? Then it gets harder. It becomes pattern recognition. At that point, what you need to do is you need to recognize that we have studied these and seen them, and you need to then recognize them as being a part of a larger formula, yes, but you need to recognize what that small formula is.
Okay, cool.
Yeah. Not so easy a task. I understand. Question, after all the others, can you explain the water-absorbing nature of brake fluid, and also if one were to drip or dip their finger in a bottle of fresh fluid, does it ruin the fluid? Eric, yeah. I have no idea. Random question, Eric. I can describe the water-absorbing nature. That's easy enough to do. Yeah, hang on, Eric. Let me deal with a couple of other things. Let me deal if there's anything else here. Ayla, you had other questions that we didn't quite finish that were on topic.
I was just curious about when you were giving them all the names, the
Yes, the IDE, the ATE names.
So are these structures that you're associating them with, is you would give them those names based on a given set, but there could be more of those structures? I don't know if that makes sense.
A little bit. I think that what I'm reading into what you're trying to ask is that we have these suffixes, ATE and ITE. And we're taking the ATE to mean more oxygen. But what does more actually mean? And it, we're taking to mean less oxygen. But what does less actually mean? Less than what? And the answer to that sort of is, this is more than it. And less than eight, which seems sort of circular. But in a sense, if I have two ions, and one of them is SO4, and one of them is SO3, then this one is going to be the eight with more, and this one is going to be the eight. And so it becomes sulfate and sulfite. It doesn't tell me how many oxygens are there. It only tells me a name that is ascribed to something that has more oxygens and a name ascribed to something that has less oxygens. And so in that same sense, when I have NO3 minus and NO2 minus, this one is the eight and this one is the eight.
So is it a fixed number of these, I guess they're ions that are being presented to name, or is it like these are just the ones that were given?
There are many more ions than this. These are the ones that we are memorizing because these are the most common that we see within the general chemistry curriculum. But there are probably hundreds, if not more, other types of ions, larger ions, more complicated ions, mixed ions. There's lots of them. And the nomenclature system is fairly conserved throughout the entire system. It's just that these are the ones that we really focus on and we learn and we memorize.
Okay, cool. Thank you so much for the clarification.
You're welcome. Okay, Edgar, we're kind of late going into class 3, and I don't know why I didn't get you added into lab and you were trying to get into lab. I thought that I had sort of gotten to everybody and given everybody add codes or permission to add into lab as they needed to. And I don't know how we missed you.
You did give me permission to get into the class. I was just never actually able to register the student planning.
Do you know why?
He just never gave me the option. And I mean, I tried to contact Cabrillo and that just... And it's nearly impossible to speak to anybody right now.
True.
Edgar,
you've been following and you've been in class every day and the lab has been tracking pretty much with the class. I wouldn't have a problem adding you into lab and I can make that happen.
It'd be great if it wouldn't be a big deal.
Okay, Edgar, let me see what I can do. And I have to talk to the dean in order to try to get it approved and push it through.
Mm-hmm.
Which lab would you want to go into, the morning or the afternoon?
I've been attending the morning lab.
You have been? You've been showing up?
Yeah.
Cool, because I know I've seen your name a lot.
I wasn't there this morning. That was the only one I've missed.
Yeah, that's okay. I record them and put them up so you can
see them.
And I don't need your student ID because I can pull it out of the lecture. So that'll be fine. And let's see what I can do.
Great, I appreciate it. I know that takes some work, so thanks for taking the time.
Yeah, I'll give it a shot. We'll see if we can make it happen. Okay, Edgar, your question, or Eric, your question. Some materials are what are called hygroscopic. I don't know what brake fluid actually, the structure of it is. Let me look real quick and see. Yeah, it's a glycol ether. That makes sense. So a glycol ether, when we look at a glycol ether, it has these molecules of glycol that have two hydroxyl groups on them. And these hydroxyl groups are then combined and polymerize in order to make a glycol ether. And it just keeps going into these long chains. And I'm gonna cut it at this point. I'm running out of room to be able to stretch it out here the way that I want to. So I'm gonna leave an OH hanging out there. This is what is called a glycol ether. And the glycol ether, these oxygens do what's called hydrogen bonding to water. And so it is very, what we call hygroscopic, meaning that it absorbs water. And it has to do with the oxygens being present in the material. So it's not hydroscopic, it's hygroscopic. And yeah, they're sort of sharing electrons in a way, in a sort of way. And so it is the nature of the material and the oxygens in the material that allow it to absorb water. And most molecules that have oxygens in them are hygroscopic and do absorb water. Second part, if one were to dip their finger in the bottle of fresh fluid, does it ruin the fluid? And the answer to that is probably no. But in essence, the brake fluid works because it is incompressible. And it is not water per se that ruins the fluid, but oxygen. And that when oxygen gets in the line and a gas gets in the line, then the material becomes compressible. And your brake pedal, as you push it down, will continue to travel as the fluid compresses with the oxygen in there. And so it is the oxygen that really ruins it, not per se dipping your finger into it. I don't think that is going to catalyze or do anything damaging per se. I could be wrong, but I don't see how that would affect anything. So that's my, for what it's worth, that's my explanation there. Okay, you guys, it is 12:30. I got a half an hour before the afternoon lab starts. I would love to go get some lunch. So unless there's anything else, I'm gonna call it quits for the afternoon. And I'll see you guys either in the afternoon lab or I'll see you tomorrow. Okay. Sounds good. Talk to you guys later. Thanks, Eric. Talk to you guys later.